And really, there's nobody on the campus that has more influence on the students. They listen more to their professors, they look up to them, than anyone else on campus. So without a good working relationship with faculty, my job is impossible. International offices that haven't had strong ties to faculty can develop those, but step by step.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of World Strides Podcast, Changing Lives Through Education Abroad, a weekly series of conversations with international education's most interesting thought leaders, as well as discussions on emerging trends, best practices, and innovation happening in our field. I'm your host, Zach McInnes, and I am so excited about this week's episode. Today, I'm looking forward to diving into a topic that I would venture to say is not discussed nearly enough in this field: how we as practitioners can be intentional in the way we collaborate with faculty members on our campuses. I am honored to welcome a very distinguished guest onto the pod who I know has not only thought a lot about this topic, but has actively shared her professional insights with the field. Dr. Patricia Sagasti-Supis is the Director of Global Engagement and Senior International Officer at Stockton University in beautiful Galloway, New Jersey. She has also held international education leadership roles at Hartwick College, Ferrum College, and Florida Southern College. In addition to being a consummate study abroad boss, Patty holds a PhD in Hispanic and Latin American literature from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and has spent many years in the classroom as a faculty member. I love the way Patty engages faculty in her capacity as SIO at Stockton, and I know she'll have takeaways for practitioners at all institutional types about how we can approach faculty as friends, not foes, and how strategic engagement can turn them into true allies. I am so excited for today's discussion. You do not want to miss this episode. Stay tuned for what's sure to be a sparkling conversation. Welcome, Patty. Thank you for being here.
It's such an honor to be on your podcast, Zach. I listened to it and I just love the good work that you're doing.
I so appreciate your kind words. Thank you. To start us off, could you please share with our listeners an overview of your professional journey and your current role at Stockton?
I started out in literature because I studied what I was passionate about and what I loved the most. So I was studying literature in Spanish, French, and English as an undergraduate at Sweetbriar College. And then I served in the Peace Corps in Morocco. I actually left early. I worked there for a year, but it was the most enriching year of my life. And I went on to graduate school in modern languages and literatures, always working within the international ed field. And once I started my faculty position, one of the very first experiences I had as a new faculty member was to lead a group to Honduras with Elon University, where I was teaching, and the students gave me the honor of choosing me to lead their program. So I was really excited to do that. After that, just the ball got rolling. And in my faculty role, I have been supporting international students. I've done advising for study abroad. I did site visits. I did on-campus programming, advocacy for international ed. And I reached a point where I realized that I had already been doing this international ed job without actually being fully in international ed. So I proposed a new office at Ferrum College where really it was just a faculty member trying to do everything all at once. And it started as half-time faculty, half-time administration, and I was running all the incoming and outgoing programs. And then I moved to a full-time SIO role, and I've been in that kind of position since then. And I've now been at Stockton for all of 4 months, so I'm still learning my way around.
Well, congratulations on your not-so-new-anymore role. I want to recognize here that you are Dr. Sagasti-Supis and have the experience and ability to bring academic and administrative lenses to your work. In what ways has your time as a faculty member informed your current approach and made you stronger in other leadership roles?
I think I have a lot of empathy for faculty and an understanding of their needs and interests. I'm also genuinely very interested in what they do. I love getting all geeky and learning about their research, and I love to continue engaging in scholarship myself. My background as an academic has informed my approach to international education which I see as an area of academic inquiry for me. I've been doing some work with global ed, and the reason that I do it is because it helps me continue to be engaged academically. I'm interested in research and writing, and I get a great deal from the reading that I do of what colleagues are thinking in the field. And I also make it a point to attend and participate in the guest lectures, art exhibits, performances, other events on campus that showcase the academic work. That does a couple of things. It not only keeps me informed about what my faculty colleagues are doing, but it also is kind of walking the walk, because we are advocates of lifelong learning. And if we are promoting lifelong learning, we should also demonstrate it.
I love that advice. Thanks for sharing that with our listeners. I know one of your particular areas of strength and scholarship is around intentional collaboration with faculty. What advice would you give to our colleagues in offices where perhaps there isn't a strong history of faculty engagement, but who wish to begin this type of partnership?
It's very difficult to get in because it's sort of like a little club. Faculty don't let you in easily. You really have to show that you care about what they're doing. You have to understand how essential they are. And really, there's nobody on the campus that has more influence on the students. They listen more to their professors, they look up to them, than anyone else on campus. So without a good working relationship with faculty, my job is impossible. International offices that haven't had strong ties to faculty can develop those, but step by step. So most of us know how to work with our faculty champions, those who naturally already are supportive of our work, who lead programs abroad, who advocate for us to get resources. We can support those leaders and highlight their work while at the same time providing opportunities for faculty who are more hesitant or who have not traditionally been engaged. I like to do a little bit of a listening tour. I'm currently still in that stage at Stockton where I'm having meetings with the school deans, with department chairs, with faculty leaders. For now, that's as much as my schedule can handle. But in the fall, I'd like to start a brown bag series so that I can get to know more people and support their work. It's all about showing that my mission and that of my office is to support the faculty's roles and not to impose things on them. So sometimes they just don't understand what we do. So when I ask what are their goals, a lot of times they tell me what their goals are for their students. And I love that, but I like to point out to them that our international partnerships offer them a lot of professional development opportunities in terms of research, collaborative teaching, international conferences, joint publications, etc. So once they know what we can do for them, they're more interested in working with us.
Thanks for sharing that, Dr. Sagasti Subas. That's very helpful. I want to ask you a follow-up question on this point. How do you go about engaging with faculty in a way that allows both their expertise to shine and supports your office's mission and goals?
So again, it's all about understanding their goals and learning about their research or the classes that they typically prefer to teach. You can help connect them with university partners that are doing work that might complement theirs, or find them a provider that understands what they're trying to accomplish and can help them meet those goals. With providers, it's all about educating the faculty that these are not travel agencies. They're educational partners run by people with higher education expertise. And that way, faculty can teach what they love and they're free to mold a class to make it exactly what they want it to be. Every time I learn about an opportunity that might fit one of my faculty, I connect them with that. I hear about a conference that's being hosted by one of our international partners, and I send that information to the chair of the appropriate department, for instance. I help them write grant proposals. I collaborate on the projects that interest them the most. For instance, I have a professor who teaches a really great course that incorporates COIL throughout the semester, and then at the end of the semester, it culminates in a visit to a Taiwanese institution with which they've been collaborating all semester. And now we're working together to look for funding so we can host a delegation and run a symposium with faculty and students from that institution here at Stockton. This is his goal. It supports his work, and it aligns with our internationalization strategy and values and the mission of our office.
I'd love to go big picture for a moment. How should study abroad practitioners think about, work with, and leverage faculty on their campus to advance international education initiatives?
So faculty are the ones that write the curriculum. They're the ones that make the choices of what the direction is for the institution. Becoming part of that process, becoming part of the planning for that would be a really great way to do that. So for instance, every couple of years, there's a change in curriculum. And if you can have an SIO or at least someone in your office be part of that curriculum change, the designing of the new curriculum, or if you can be part of the strategic planning for the institution itself, get yourself in the committees that are making the decisions, because those are some of the big overarching things that are happening. And it's faculty who are making most of those choices.
I love the advice you said there about, you know, it reminds me of Hamilton, the room where it happens, you know, making sure that you join those committees and have a seat at the table. You know, I would venture to say that one thing I don't hear enough about is the faculty perspective when it comes to study abroad. What do you wish education abroad practitioners understood about faculty priorities, interests, and competing obligations?
So I think a lot of times faculty, especially those who didn't benefit themselves from study abroad, see it as a nice to have, but don't understand how essential it is. How I've worked to educate faculty is really in small groups, in bigger groups. I do presentations. I go to where they are. I work on giving them an idea of what are the opportunities. I work on myth busting, because the faculty's fall into the same myths that the students do, that it's unaffordable, they won't finish on time, that it's not related to their program. And you just break down all of those barriers one after another. And then you give them talking points. This is what I'd love for you to talk to your students about. Don't ask them if they want to study abroad. Ask them, what are your plans for study abroad? And what I did at Hartwick, I thought was really useful. I did a sort of presentation to the entire faculty, and then I followed up with smaller meetings with departments. And if they went through my training, I gave them a little badge that said, ask me about study abroad, that they could put on their door so that everywhere that students went, they would see that badge. I did that with the faculty. I also did that with the different departments, offices, and student support services. But this meant that the students were getting the same message from everywhere. That was really essential in getting the numbers boosted. And it really, I was surprised at how quickly numbers were boosted. But faculty champions are essential for that.
I love that example. It reminds me of one of our very first episodes here on Changing Lives when Sarah Malloy, who is the director at the University of Arkansas, she created a Study Abroad Champions program that did a lot of what you just said. Give faculty something they can put in their email signature or on their door to just sort of like let students and others on campus know that they're allies of study abroad and how important that is.
I heard that episode and I have tagged it so I can go back because I love her ideas and I want to use them.
Shout out to our friend Sarah Malloy, friend of the pod. It's clear to me that faculty members have a lot to consider when deciding how to spend their time. What are some factors that would go into a decision to lead a travel course?
So one of the things that we don't often consider is that a lot of times there are no incentives for faculty to do this. It's a lot of extra unpaid work. They take on a lot of extra responsibility and risk. There's generally no specific way to put it into their tenure and promotion portfolio. So there's really not a lot of recognition. One of the things I'm doing at Stockton, and I've done this before, sometimes successfully and sometimes not as much, is advocating for us to include teaching travel courses as a specific listed and measurable part of the tenure and promotion application. I've spoken with the deans about this, and I'm going to continue to advocate for it. So in the meantime, if it's not spelled out in the faculty handbook, and international education offices should become familiar with their faculty handbook. But if it's not spelled out in the faculty handbook, you can help faculty who are preparing their portfolio to articulate their international work in terms of one or more of the three pillars on which they're typically evaluated, which is teaching, scholarship, and service. Teaching abroad, a lot of times, works with all three of those. You touch on them differently. So you need to help the faculty create a narrative that tells the story of what they've done abroad with students is so essential to their work. That's not something we typically do. We don't spend time helping faculty put together their tenure portfolio because that seems like it's outside of our scope. But if you know that there are faculty who do this type of work and that they are going up for promotion, it doesn't hurt to offer to help them with that piece.
I think about some of my colleagues here at World Stars and at other organizations who work with faculty members. And oftentimes, a faculty member's entry point into working with a provider like WorldStrides Higher Ed is through the custom programs piece. I'm curious if you have any advice for our colleagues on the provider side of the house about best practices in the way they work with faculty.
For providers, I think that it could be, so you're not going to have access to helping faculty with their tenure stuff, but you do have a narrative that you can give them. You can explain to them how you can make this job a lot easier for them. You can explain how important you all are for things like risk management, health and safety abroad. When the faculty member isn't having to consider the logistics of how they're going to get from this place to that place, or when they're going to buy tickets to a particular location or who their guide is going to be, they're free to focus on their academics, which is the thing they love the most anyway. So that's where you all shine. You're able to help people do their jobs better without having to worry about the things that they don't necessarily enjoy doing.
Patty, you and I have talked about this a lot. And I know that many of our listeners are also consummate readers of the Chronicle of Higher Education and Inside Higher Ed, to name a few. So we'll be somewhat familiar with these issues. But the landscape for faculty is a complicated one right now, with concerns around censorship and the erosion of tenure. Could you share with our listeners some of your insights on this topic and how these issues might influence how faculty interface with or dedicate time to education abroad?
This is a huge disruption, and it puts a lot of pressure on faculty, especially in states that have censoring laws in the books. We've been developing a culture of anti-intellectualism in this country for many years. And in the academy, it's a cause for a rift between schools and departments. We're already pretty fractured as it is, and it causes more fractures. The humanities, for instance, has been the hardest hit. And I say that having come from the humanities, but it's been the hardest hit by cuts, the devaluation of what they do, lack of support. They're losing majors in droves, largely because of the national rhetoric that incorrectly tells students that studying languages or philosophy, for instance, is useless and that they won't find a job. The research shows that's not true at all. When there are few majors in your field, faculty lines get shifted to pre-professional programs like business and nursing. Then there's a resentment that develops because of it. There's also overwork, heavy course loads, etc. It's frankly the reason that I left teaching. The workload was killing me. And it makes the idea of taking on a big project like taking students abroad seem like just too much. So when I approach faculty, I try to keep this in mind, and I stress the ways my office can help them achieve these goals. And that if we work together, perhaps we can increase the interest in their programs, help them grow, help them attract new majors and minors to their program. That's a really important thing for them. Because when you're teaching an upper level class that only has, you know, 10 students in it, then you are being scrutinized by upper level administration for cuts. And you can't sustain that for very long. So you need to make sure that you're helping those faculty grow their programs by bringing more interest. Any student who studies a language abroad, in my experience, if they're a minor, they're going to come back and say, I'd like to double major with Spanish or French. It's very rare that they don't at least increase the number of classes they take, if not change their program entirely.
And I think this is the space where, you know, the average education abroad practitioner may not be as comfortable to speak to. If you were to work with a faculty member in, say, studio art or some of the less popular degrees on how an education abroad program can grow their overall enrollment. So really, like, what you're getting at, my friend, is true partnership. And I just love it. Having had the opportunity to collaborate with you over the years, I know you to be a very thoughtful person about partnership and partnership best practices. As Stockton, you work with numerous partners, including providers, exchange partners, and think about complexities such as setting up dual degrees. What would you like to share on this topic of truly productive collaboration?
I think that since we've been talking mostly about the faculty perspective, I'm going to stick with that for a little bit and say there are just so many opportunities for faculty. So I've already mentioned what working with a provider can bring to a faculty member. And for an institution, it also gives us a breadth of programs we wouldn't be able to have only with our university exchange partners. But the university exchanges give them such a lot of opportunity for research, for collaborative work. I think that there are opportunities. There are things that I would like to see and do that I haven't gotten a chance to see and do yet because I'm new here. But I want to start having some virtual conferences for our faculty so that they can interact with our partners. We are going to have some more visits from partners. I'd like for those visits to, currently it's simply meeting with the dean, but I want to make opportunities to have them have conversations with the faculty as well. Partnerships have to be done carefully. You can't just partner with everybody. And I think that overall, international education offices are doing a really good job of moving in the direction of culling the partnerships that aren't really being very productive. I call it benign neglect. If a partner is not responding to me, I sort of allow the agreement to sort of fade into the background. If they are interacting with me, then I want to know more. I want to have meetings and I want to talk to them about what we can do besides that you send us two students and we send you two students. I want all of our partnerships to be productive. I don't want them to be just sort of, we keep renewing for the sake of having their name on our webpage. And it's a strategic project that takes time and patience. I have a partnership board in my office. It lists all of our university partners. When I got this office, I asked for an 8-foot long whiteboard. And my colleague looked at me and said, what on earth are you going to do with an 8-foot long whiteboard? Well, there's barely room on that whiteboard now because I've been keeping track on that whiteboard of all of our university partners, all of our provider partners, and where we are with each of those partnerships. And I have it color-coded because I'm that kind of nerd. And it really helps me keep track of where I'm going and which of these are really helping my strategic goals.
I, too, am a fan of a color-coded whiteboard, and I'm very impressed by the one in your office, my friend. I'd love to give you the opportunity to highlight a really thoughtful initiative you are spearheading this summer at Stockton, a 2-day Faculty Development Summer Institute. Tell our listeners, please, what you've got up your sleeve for this program, how it came about, and what your goals are.
I was so excited to hear that Stockton had these summer institutes, and I wrote a proposal. They fund the institutes. They fund the faculty to attend the institutes. And mine is all about creating faculty-led programs abroad. I don't want it to be 2 days of me talking. I get tired of hearing myself talk. So I've invited you and other partners, and I'm very excited to have you come. And I'm also inviting some campus partners so that we can go through things like the basic risk management and health and safety abroad, but also curricular integration, how to better support students that need accommodations, how to deal with students who have different identities and what those identities might mean when they go abroad. I'm also going to go through the process here. That's why the campus partners are coming. So what forms do you need to fill out? How do you create your budget? How do you process contracts on our campus? I'm inviting those partners on campus because the process is currently not smooth, and I want to smooth it out so that faculty aren't constantly stressed out and sending me notes saying, are we done with this yet? Are we done with that yet? Did we done this? What else do I need to do? I don't want there to be questions. I want it to be a smooth process for them. I think that this institute is going to give them an opportunity to talk to each other, to share ideas, and to also talk to you all and find out how they can work with you or how they can work with our university partners to save students money, to have more robust programs, to make sure that their academic goals are met.
Continuing to be impressed with the intentionality behind this initiative. We're excited to see it come together. And there's a lot about the Summer Institute that makes it exemplary of best practices in our field. I want to lift up, too, that faculty apply to be a part of this program and are compensated for their involvement. Naturally, when you invest in people, they, in turn, are going to feel a sense of investment in the initiative that they're a part of. How are you thinking about the impact on campus that this Summer Institute will have longitudinally?
Well, I spoke earlier about faculty champions, and I'm hoping that I'm going to develop some faculty champions that not only will understand and support the work that we do, but also will know the complexities and will know what we need in order to move forward. I don't want to have just faculty champions that say, yay, study abroad is great. I want faculty champions to understand how we can really integrate it into the curriculum and how their colleagues can also benefit from working with my office. I want them to actively go out and support our program. And I think that that's with a small group, we're only going to have 12. That's really important. This is something that Stockton does, and I'm so proud to be part of the Stockton community. This is something that Stockton does that's really special because these summer institutes, the fact that they're funded, I have not run across that in the private institutions where I've worked before. If you do something in the summer, it's volunteer work on the part of the faculty. And that doesn't give you the incentive that you need to get them to participate. It also, it's unfair. It's not good practice. I'm really excited that Stockton approaches it in a different way.
You know, I want to ask you a follow-up on that point because what you just raised is, to me, a really interesting point. I know faculty members are often asked to participate in non-compensated activities. They're often asked to serve on committees. They're often asked to do other things that are outside of the classroom. How should we be thinking about this in education abroad?
Yes, faculty are always asked to do extra things. We have to remember that they're paid to work for 10 months. And I try not to ask them to even so much as answer emails in the summer unless it's absolutely necessary. Faculty of color, minority faculty, women do a disproportionate amount of that committee work, of that outside work. I know as a Latina faculty member, I was all over campus doing every single thing. I was in every committee. It was partly because I was asked to be, and partly because I didn't feel comfortable saying no. And what we need to do as international educators is understand and just don't ask, because sometimes they don't feel comfortable saying no to you. They feel like they have something to prove because they're in the minority and they're afraid that they won't be promoted, they won't be recognized, or their program will be cut. It's especially important to not put that burden on people who are already overburdened.
I want to return to the Summer Institute for a moment. Anyone who has worked in higher ed for a meaningful amount of time will understand that resources will vary quite a bit between institutions. What are some takeaways from a project like the Summer Institute that could translate to any campus?
So if you don't have the financial support for creating something like that Summer Institute, there are other ways that you can approach it. It's going to be more work for the international office, unfortunately, but I think it sometimes putting a lot of work in the short term can save you a lot of work in the long term. I'm doing two things with that Summer Institute. I'm running the actual institute, but at the same time, I'm creating a lot of materials that I'm going to be using in it that I'm going to put into a Blackboard course. And that Blackboard course will be the training that faculty will be getting for any program abroad that they take. So the Blackboard course, I'm being intentional about what I put in it, how much time I expect out of people, and they can do it during the times that they're on campus, during the times they're being paid. Or if they choose to, they can do it in the summer, but it's their choice. I'm not requiring it. It's self-guided. It's not synchronous. So giving them options is a really good way of helping faculty be able to do these things in institutions that maybe don't have the resources to give them those funds. And you can also take a look at what ways that you can use their faculty development funds, because every institution has some amount of faculty development, whether it's a couple hundred dollars or a couple thousand dollars. if you can help the faculty find really interesting ways to use that money when in international education, that's really great. A lot of times I've seen faculty not use their funds. And yearly, say you are entitled to $1,200 a year in faculty development funds. If you're not using it, that's a waste. And it could be because you're too busy. What if the International Education Office helps you find training, helps you find, for instance, training in COIL? That's only, I think it's like $300 or $400. It's not very expensive to train to teach a COIL class, but training is so much a better approach than having to try to figure it out on your own. If you help them find those opportunities to use their faculty development funds, however little they might be, that's a good way to use the institutional support wherever it is or however much it is.
You know, we talk a lot about meeting students where they are in the field, but what you're talking about is meeting faculty where they are as well, which I really love. And one of the many things I respect about you, my friend, is your deep commitment to social justice. How are you incorporating this critical focus into your work at Stockton University?
It's all about collaboration. So one of the first things I did was I got on the Committee for Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging. And I work with the Offices of Student Success, the Educational Opportunities Fund, which is a New Jersey program, the Diversity and Inclusion Office, our Women's and LGBTQ Center, our Veteran Support Center, et cetera, because if I can collaborate with them, I can understand better what their needs are, what the needs of their students are, and I can give more opportunities for students in these areas. When I create a project, a major campaign to increase the numbers of students going abroad, my goal isn't just to increase the numbers of students going abroad. My goal is to also increase the diversity of the students who are going and the diversity of destinations to where they're going. So as I'm working with my committee to develop a new mission for my office, one of the most important things we're putting is a decolonization of education abroad. And decolonization can mean a lot of things, but it, to me, is sort of woven through who participates, where they're going, what types of programs are they going. It's not sufficient to go to Honduras if what you're doing is a white savior mission sort of thing. You have to actually do something that approaches the study of that culture through a cultural humility lens. It's woven through everything that we do. And I think a lot of international offices are heading in a direction that I find really very inspiring.
Patty, I understand you're working collaboratively on a book, as if you don't have enough going on already, my friend. Could you tell us a bit about what you've got in store?
Well, I'm going to shout out Todd Lee Gowan. Todd and I have been working on this because we started out by thinking about the collaborations between international offices and faculty, and how those could improve. He was faculty and is now an SIO, and so am I. And what we decided was to start with a session at NAFSA, and we did a session in Denver with a couple of other really great colleagues who had the same sorts of background, but were all from different types of institutions. And the place was packed. There were a million questions. There was a lot of follow-up reaching out to us afterwards, and we said, well, there's really a need for this. So we're working on a book on how international offices will better work with faculty, and it's not going to be just our voices. So Todd and I are working on the chapters together, but we're working on very short chapters, which will then have some reactions from folks in the field who've had experience with faculty. And so if we write the intro to a chapter, a couple of different colleagues are going to respond to what we've written and add their own wisdom. So we're excited about it because it's not only one voice.
I love that. And we'd love to invite you and Todd back onto the show once your book is published. So congratulations, all the exciting progress in that area. I just have one more question for you today. Patty, as you think about education abroad in 2024, what makes you hopeful?
things like this podcast, things like the work that you're doing, this is what makes me hopeful. I go to these conferences, I hear about the amazing work colleagues are doing. I'm so humbled that you invited me to come here because honestly, I hear about other people doing this incredible work and I'm constantly inspired. I was just at AIEA. I'm getting ready to go to NAFSA. I could not be more buzzed about going to NAFSA because I'm already planning all the meetings, all the sessions that I want to attend and learn from colleagues. I feel like the pandemic really hit us hard, but we have come back so strong and having learned so many things. What makes me hopeful is the people.
I can't imagine a better place to end things than right there. Dr. Patricia Sagasti-Subas, what an inspiring and enlightening conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Zach. This has been such a pleasure.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode of Changing Lives Through Education Abroad. I am your host, Zach McGinnis, and please make sure to join us next week as we continue to explore topics around international education and exchange. Thank you to my spectacular World Strides colleagues, Lindsay Kelcher and Sarah Kachuba, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Please subscribe to Changing Lives Through Education Abroad on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and share with your friends and colleagues. Let's create life-changing moments together.